It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My next guest will be familiar to many television viewers in the Peoria, Bloomington area. Gary Moore was a longtime news anchor on WEEK-TV's morning show, 25 News Today. He got his start in radio as the only African-American on air at a country music station. Today, he's operations and programming director at the radio station WPNV-FM, which is 106.3 in Peoria, and he's a middle school music teacher. Now, he's written a book distilling his long experience in media and the sometimes fraught experiences outlets have with race, both in newsrooms and in newscasts. It's called The Little Black Book for Journalists Unafraid of Race. In order to make our schedules meet, I spoke with Moore yesterday afternoon. One content warning, in just under 5 minutes, you're going to hear Moore quote a racial epithet. Really, the worst epithet you can use with someone who's African-American. It's in the context of his recalling a phone call he took many years ago at that country music station. Gary Moore, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you for speaking with me.
I want to talk about your first job in broadcasting. You got your start at a country music station, WXEL, and a lot of the listeners there, you say they didn't know you were black. What was that like?
So this was in the late 70s, early 90s. I was a senior in college, and there was a thing called the Minority Internship Program. And one of my professors on the speech team, the late, great George Armstrong, called and said, "Hey, I got a job for you this summer. What are you doing?" There's a country western radio station that has a minority internship program, and you can go there and work and learn everything about radio under this wise man named Bill Marlowe, God rest his soul. And I said, sure, I'm not doing anything. Now, I was raised in the South Side of Chicago, and being African-American raised in the South Side of Chicago, the prospect of working at a country western radio station culturally, you know, it was like, okay, I don't know what to expect here, but hey, I'm game for it, right? And I think one of the things that we should note, though, is the fact that this country western radio station had a minority internship program. That speaks to the times that post-civil rights era, you're into the affirmative action phase where a lot of institutions, organizations, media outlets, whomever, thought that it was important to give African-Americans, people who are disenfranchised, underserved, a shot and open their doors. And besides myself, the only other black people at the station were the janitor and the receptionist. And I think that was kind of pretty much the case for a lot of us who were the first, those pioneers who went through those doors that were open. And yeah, my voice, I guess you could say classic Midwestern style voice or whatever. You know, I was on the speech team by then. And in my broadcast, I didn't have what my speech coach would call these pronounced colloquialisms, you know, or back then they used to call it Ebonics, or to talk with a black accent, or in slang, or black dialect, or, you know, what have you. I grew up, you know, on the South Side of Chicago, and my conversation many times, you know, would drift into neighborhood speak. But the when it came to code shifting from a professional standpoint, you know, I did the news, I did public affairs shows, and so no, people didn't know.
You talk about, though, that creating some friction, or maybe friction is not the right way to say it, but if you can tell the story, you got a call inviting you to an event, and the organizer warned you that it was near a public housing project.
Right, and so one of the organizers of an event was one of the listeners to the radio station and called and said, "Hey, I listen to you and Don Elliott every morning, and you're my favorite." And Don Elliott was the DJ, and I was the news guy in the morning. And, you know, just wanted to invite you all down to an event. You know, now, you know, the event is going to be at the Taft Homes housing project. So, you know, it's going to be near there. So, you know, you be careful because you know how those people are. And so Honestly, I had some fun with him on the phone, like, so how are those people? So tell me more about these people and this kind of thing. And then I think midway through the conversation, he decoded that I was African American and then kind of backed off. Now, that wasn't the only phone call. I remember getting a phone call from a lady who was very concerned about her son who was incarcerated in the Illinois prison system and talked to me how he was beaten up and how the guards, mistreated him. And then one day a bunch of niggers jumped on him and blah, blah, blah. And in the background, her daughter or someone else that, whispered, Mom, how do you know he's not black or, whatever. And then I engaged her in a conversation about the use of the word and that, yeah, indeed, I was African American and I took offense to that. But I didn't not help her. I still processed her phone call and tried to connect her to, someone who could be of assistance to her. And let me just say, to back up a little bit, the average African American, dare I say, experiences similar type things. You talk to any black professional in a predominantly white workforce, and they'll tell you similar things. They're mistaken for the custodian. They're mistaken for the janitor, or they are not regarded as having the position that they have. And there are these Randall Robinson calls them these ceaseless slights, these microaggressions, these abrasions and scrapes and cuts that you sadly get used to. And it's not that you get numb to them, but you do get used to them. And it becomes just the way things are. And the thing that I wanted to show in the book was that from a media standpoint, implicit bias, those kinds of microaggressions or abrasions that African Americans suffer, because of the job that we have in media, because we are gatekeepers, because we decide what people see and we write the stories and put them in context. If we have bias, if we have ethnic notions and negative perceptions, those things have a way of working their way into our work, into the copy, into the stories. And they can color, no pun intended, the way our audiences view that particular story in ways that are not always healthy.
Well, you have been in the field now from a time when you were the first, the only, and many of your colleagues at other stations and outlets were the first or the only. And things have changed now, but what do you think of journalism today?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I think we're still challenged. I think corporations now have made a big impact on our work, on our field. My brothers at SAG-AFTRA on the entertainment side are on strike, out in Hollywood and New York and other big production houses, in terms of the value that they feel is being threatened for the quality of our work. And that's one of the things that's really pressing on the field. And I'll give you a couple of examples. A lot of people know that running parallel to my career on air and in the field, I was also the union president for SAG-AFTRA, for the Peoria affiliate, the Peoria local, for many years, for most of the years that I was in television. And so I helped negotiate contracts and represent people when it came to grievances against the country, anywhere from, didn't get their overtime or sick days, all the way up to, arbitrated cases. And one of the more classic cases involved a hedge fund that owned our station, that bought our station. And they were mainly concerned with the bottom line to the point where on the weekends we had a person who left. So you have a skeletal crew, you got an anchor, a reporter, a photographer, the weather guy, the sports guy, and that's it. and the weather guy left, took another job, and the station didn't want to replace them. And instead of replacing them, they said, oh, you know what? We own another station. We own a fleet of stations. And so we can get this weathercast done in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Our weather guy there can record some news, send you guys the tape, and you can run it during the weather slot for your local news. We protested. We filed a grievance. The station fought us all the way to arbitration. And the arbitrator eventually ruled in our favor that this was a health risk, because the person who was in Fort Wayne didn't know the local community. We're in what's called Tornado Alley. The weather changed. You could forecast something in the morning, but by the afternoon it would have changed. He was mispronouncing the name of local towns. He, you know, a lot of times the tape that they would send would crinkle on the air. And so there was just a number of things that were wrong with that. But it's an example of how corporate weight and pressure really put us in a compromising position in terms of our ability to do our jobs. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that is a challenge to our industry now. You know, I watch a lot of people who are young who get brought into our business. They don't really have a whole lot of time to get trained properly, you know, to go the 2 or 3 years, you know, out in the streets, out in the field, learning the craft, learning how to write, how to, you know, put stories in context, developing some institutional knowledge about the community. And then you get elevated to sit at the anchor desk. You know, a lot of times now, because stations are stretched to fill up shows, you know, they hire kids right out of college and, you know, put them in front of the anchor desk. And, you know, I feel sorry for some of our young people, because, you know, they genuinely want to get into the business, but they're not prepared. The viewers don't necessarily like what they're seeing, because they're seeing inexperienced people. And so the quality of the product suffers. And so we're kind of in that space right now. And I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it definitely does. One of the things, so let's return to the book now. So one of the things you say in the book, and maybe this does interface with this sort of disinvestment we've seen, and I come from a newspaper background before I got into radio, and I have definitely seen the disinvestment there as well, often from these out-of-town companies. But one of the things the book points out or suggests is that newsroom operations really need this diversity, equity, and inclusion component. And so maybe you can talk about that and how, you know, maybe some of the funding constraints that media is facing cut against those goals sometimes.
You can't have fair reporting on your society without your organization being fairly represented of the demographics of your society. If you don't have or people who have diversity, equity, training, experience, then, or, you know then the value of diversity. You know, there was a time where I was myself, President Obama, and someone who committed a crime or was involved in the criminal justice system, that was the only time you saw a black person on our station, on the news. So if you tune into the news, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 5 o'clock, whenever, if I wasn't doing the news and you didn't see President Obama, the only time you saw a black person was if they had committed a crime or they're a victim of crime or something like that. And so I told the news director, assignment editor, hey, you know what? Maybe we should take a forest view, you know, take a step back, look at the stories we've done over the course of the week. Because here's the deal. news by nature, if it bleeds, it leads. So let's say you're serving up a plate of food to someone. The big hunkin' piece of protein, the big hunkin' piece of meat on the plate is going to be crime. You know, fire, police, something happening. You know, it's sexy. It's where the majority of our tax dollars go. So we're going to cover, you know, this homicide or this crime or whatever. It is a fact that African Americans are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. And so it stands to reason that you're going to get African American subjects in those reports. Okay. But 65-75% of the black men who are out here in the world are teachers and you know, post office workers and workers at Walmart and everyday people doing everyday things. That 25% or 30% that's represented in the criminal justice system, albeit disproportionately represented, are not the only game in town when it comes to what black men are doing. And so if we're doing a story on gas prices or inflation, and we're doing the proverbial man on the street or woman on the street and just asking people, hey, how do you feel about inflation? Or how do you feel about this? The assignment editor or news director has to be intentional and deliberate and say to their reporter, while you're out in the field, find a black man or a black woman to talk to. Now, it sounds weird, but that is the only way that you are going to make a dent in this perception issue.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. We're speaking with Gary Moore, who for many years was news anchor at WEEK-TV in Peoria. He is also the author of The Little Black Book for Journalists Unafraid of Race. We're going to continue this conversation when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Gary Moore, who is the former anchor at WEEK-TV. But more to the point for our conversation today, he's the author of The Little Black Book for Journalists Unafraid of Race. We've been talking about his long experience in media, particularly as it relates to being African American. We taped this conversation yesterday in order to accommodate Mr. Moore's schedule, so we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Before the break, we were talking about representation in the newsroom, and you mentioned that you were always, or at least for a long time, the go-to person for answers on the African-American community. I wonder how you felt about that.
I had mixed feelings about it. At first, I was a little put off by it because it's like, you know, so Gary, how come black people don't like Larry Bird? And it's like, I like Larry Bird, you know, why? You know, well, all the black guys I talk to, they don't like Larry Bird and blah, blah. And so when you have a friendship with someone and a genuine friendship and a genuine yearning to know, then I'm thinking, who else are my white colleagues going to feel comfortable asking these questions to? And so I embraced it. I mean, the fact that I was a cultural arts presenter and quack historian, you know, I reveled in local history and history in general. So, you know, I knew a little bit about the subjects that they were asking about, but I would always qualify them by saying, this is just my opinion, you know, and you can find out more if you read this or do that. I was always pushing books, you know, encouraging people to read more and develop their own knowledge about something, because you don't just want to go by what I say. But no, I think that's in a way, I think it's okay. You know, it's like, but just know that that person, that ambassador, doesn't have all the answers. You know, that ambassador syndrome, I think, is something that, you know, we should talk about also, because that can be a very negative thing if indeed you have someone who does not represent their particular group well. And one of the things that I noted in the book was that as a part of a diversity training session that we did, we talk about this fictional person, Hector the Ambassador. And let's say you don't have any Hispanic people in your workplace, and you decide to hire Hector, and you welcome him with open arms, and he's, you know, great sense of humor, whatever. And then one day you notice there's some money missing. And the next couple of days there's some computers missing. And the next couple of days there's some other stuff missing. And then on your way to work, you pass by the parking lot and you look inside Hector's car and you see some of the stuff that's missing peeking out from, you know, under this cover. Okay, so Hector is a thief. He's arrested and he's out of there. And then we have an opening and Juan applies. And so people will say, well, you know, I don't know about hiring Juan. You know what happened with the last one we hired, you know. So that whole ambassador thing is something that we have to watch, because, you know, one person, unfortunately, you know, when you're the only person representing that minority group, let's say you hire, you know, black female and she's a horrible writer, you know, and she, you know, botches up stories and stuff like that. And, you know, it's like, well, we took a chance on hiring a, you know, black person, but, you know, this is what we got. So that's it. And so, you know, what, you're not going to hire, you're not going to give another black person a chance because you had a negative experience with this one. You know, these are just things that, you know, we have to be mindful of and be careful about.
I mean, it seems self-evident that, but how do you fight that? How do you get news directors to break out of that thinking?
I don't know. I mean, I think that that's a bigger question for people. If you notice in the book, at the end of each chapter, I ask questions and I don't answer the questions because I think I don't, because I don't have all the, because I don't have all the answers, you know. That photographer who talked about, you know, the greasy Mexican guy, you know, if the photographer showed no bias in the way he shot the story that he was on, what's the harm? You know, should I have reported it to the news manager? Again, should the assignment editor trust him on a story about Mexicans? Shouldn't we be able to speak openly about our feelings and opinions without being judged? You know, are there any off-limit conversations? You know, these are all things that we should be discussing in our newsrooms. And, you know, a lot of times we don't have those kinds of tough discussions, but needed discussions. I'm glad to say that, you know, in my limited distribution of the book, I've talked to news directors, Perry Box in Paducah, Kentucky. He bought, you know, several copies of the book, distributed them among his staff, and they have discussions about them. My buddy Sean Newell at WNBD, he's now, I think, general manager or vice president or something. He bought a series of books and passed them out to staff and said he thinks it would be a good idea if once a week, you know, they read one of the essays and then talked about the questions afterwards. So, you know, I think it just, it begins with an awareness, you know, and an admission that we do have some, that everybody has a little Archie Bunker in them, right? I mean, you have to admit that first. And then how does that impact the work that we do? You know, we've had, man, some really horrible situations. I mean, I've, you know, the greasy Mexican guy, I mean, you could say that's a horrible thing. But, I mean, we've had situations where, you know, we had the Ferguson shooting of Michael Brown. You come in the morning and I'm ready to, you know, that's probably going to be my lead story. And it's nowhere in the first block, and it's not in the second block, and it's not in the third, it's not in the fourth block, and it's not in the first half hour, and it's not in the second half hour. and it's not in the third half hour. And so during the commercial, before we go to a commercial, I tease, hey, and coming up, we're going to have, more on this big national story, right? And I go into the newsroom and I ask our young producer, so what's up with this? He doesn't think it was important. Okay, why don't you think it was important? Wait, I have to go back on the air. Save your answer and put it in the news. Okay. why don't you think that's important? And so we have a good conversation about, he later said, he had some form of black fatigue that, lately we had been doing a number of stories on black people and he thought we had done our quota on them and stuff like that. I mean, it's these are conversations that we just have to have. To find out where people are and to remind them of what their job is and remind them of how important our job is as gatekeepers of information and what we serve up to the public. It's something similar. We at the end of each newscast, you have what's called a kicker, a little lighthearted story. And we end tonight
The
with
squirrel
a
on
funny.
water skis or something is the
Yeah,
proverbial
squirrel
one,
on water
yes.
skis. Right, exactly. But when it involves people, we end tonight with, a funny story out of India where they've come up with a cure for baldness, where the cows lick the heads of the people, and the follicles on their tongue, connect with the follicles on their scalp, and the hair grows. Ha ha ha. So what's the weather going to be like? Well, we don't have any cows falling out the sky tonight, but, blah, blah, blah. Right? Okay. So I noticed there was a pattern, where night in and night out, and we end tonight with a funny story out of Thailand where they're having, some kind of cheese ball, blah, blah, blah. We end tonight with a story out of Guatemala where, and so whoever was producing these kickers were mining the international news feed or culling stories from the international news feed so that the only time you saw black, brown, red, yellow people were when they were doing something stupid and goofy. It wasn't like we were covering the Thailand City Council or you had, something else, right? And so those are just things to be mindful of, that the only time your viewers are going to see people from these other countries is going to be when they're doing something stupid. Now, our viewers, you would think they would be intelligent enough to know that that's not the only thing that these people do. But nowadays, in the era of I can say anything and it may resonate with, people, I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can assume that. I think our job is to be as fair and responsible as possible.
We're coming toward the end of our time together. I did want to ask you. You interviewed the white supremacist Matthew Hale once, right? I wonder today, nowadays, there's a lot of talk in media about should you even give someone a quote unquote platform, right? Never mind that, we think our job is to ask tough questions, and there's a difference between just letting someone on the air and talking and challenging their views. But I wonder what you think of that. Would you do that interview today?
Sure. I'd be a lot tougher on him than I was then. I got criticized back then for not being tougher on Matt Hale. I didn't think I was asking him softball questions or anything. I was just trying, to have him speak so that people could hear his point of view, clearly. But yeah, I'd do it again. Because I think people need to know what's out there. Now, I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, that all of us watched the 2016 campaign where, and this is not any kind of political statement, but where former President Trump, you'd have a crowded field of, 16 or 17 Republicans on the stage, and they'd be talking about policy stuff and foreign affairs and the economy and this kind of thing. And Trump would talk about somebody's mother or how ugly somebody is or call somebody a name. And that would be the soundbite that would carry the news cycle. And in retrospect, I think a lot of media outlets are looking back at that and how they covered that campaign and wondering whether or not they were unwittingly giving him more of a platform than he deserved, because our tendency is to look at the abnormal and weird and showcase it. So.
I struggle with this myself sometimes because, like you said, I think to me, I hear somebody like Matthew Hale, who is this notorious white supremacist. I think he's still in federal prison for attempting to arrange the murder of a judge.
Of a judge, yeah.
I hear his words and it's disqualifying. And maybe I would think, well, that's enough. He is disqualifying himself with his words. But people want reporters to be more. I don't know, to say how disqualifying that is, maybe. I don't know what you think of that.
I don't know. I think we want to hesitate to throw in a lot of our opinion. You know, now that I have my own radio station and, you know, I get to do interviews and occasionally you might hear my opinion about something here or there, but I'm you know, from the old school, so I don't, you know, I check myself and I hear myself if I do that, you know, and I just, you know, want to make sure that the person that I'm interviewing, it's mostly their point of view than mine. But yeah, we are here to report, but we're also here to put things in context. And that speaks to another level of service, because it's one thing for you to simply report that someone has done something or said something. It's another thing for you to, at the end of that reporting, tag that with, and by the way, you know, this person donated X amount to this organization, or that this person served X amount of years in prison for this or that. You know, I mean, you have to put things in context, and then your listeners or viewers are better informed about where that person is coming from.
Gary Moore is the author of The Little Black Book for Journalists Unafraid of Race. If you want to obtain a copy, you should email him directly. We'll have a link for doing so at our website, 21stShow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.